low cost, and to create a new value curve, there are four key questions to challenge an industry's strategic logic and business model. Which of the factors that the industry takes for granted should be eliminated? Which factors should be reduced well below the industry's standard? Which factors should be raised well above the industry's standard? Which factors should be created that the industry has never offered? The first question forces you to consider eliminating factors that companies in your industry have long competed on. Often those factors are taken for granted, even though they no longer have value or may even detract from value. Sometimes there is a fundamental change in what buyers value, but companies that are focused on benchmarking one another do not act on or even perceive the change. The second question forces you to determine whether products or services have been over-designed in the race to match and beat the competition. Here, companies over-serve customers, increasing their cost structure for no gain. The third question pushes you to uncover and eliminate the compromises your industry forces customers to make. The fourth question helps you discover entirely new sources of value for buyers and to create new demand and shift the strategic pricing of the industry. It is by pursuing the first two questions, of eliminating and reducing, that you gain insight into how to drop your cost structure vis-a-vis competitors. Our research has found that rarely do managers systematically set out to eliminate and reduce their investments in factors that an industry competes on. The result is mounting cost structures and complex business models. The second two factors, by contrast, provide you with insight into how to lift buyer value and create new demand. Collectively, they allow you to systematically explore how you can reconstruct buyer value elements across alternative industries to offer buyers an entirely new experience, while simultaneously keeping your cost structures low. Of particular importance are the actions of eliminating and creating, which push companies to go beyond value maximization exercises with existing factors of competition. Eliminating and creating prompt companies to change the factors themselves, hence making the existing rules of competition irrelevant. When you apply the four actions framework to the strategy canvas of your industry, you get a revealing new look at old perceived truths. In the case of the U.S. wine industry, by thinking in terms of these four actions vis-a-vis the current industry logic, and looking across alternatives and non-customers, Casella Wines created Yellowtail, a wine whose strategic profile broke from the competition and created a blue ocean. Instead of offering wine as wine, Casella created a social drink accessible to everyone, beer drinkers, cocktail drinkers, and other drinkers of non-wine beverages. In the space of 2 years, the fun social drink Yellowtail emerged as the fastest-growing brand in the histories of both the Australian and the U.S. wine industries, and the number one imported wine into the United States, surpassing the wines of France and Italy. By August 2003, it was the number one red wine in a 750-milliliter bottle sold in the United States, outstripping California labels. By mid-2003, Yellowtail's moving average annual sales were tracking at 4.5 million cases. In the context of a global wine glut, Yellowtail has been racing to keep up with sales. What's more, whereas large wine companies developed strong brands over decades of marketing investment, Yellowtail leapfrogged tall competitors with no promotional campaign, mass media, or consumer advertising. It didn't simply steal sales from competitors, it grew the market. Yellowtail brought non-wine drinkers, beer and ready-to-drink cocktail consumers, into the wine market. Moreover, novice table wine drinkers started to drink wine more frequently, jug wine drinkers moved up, and drinkers of more expensive wines moved down to become consumers of Yellowtail. By looking at the alternatives of beer and ready-to-drink cocktails and thinking in terms of non-customers, Casella Wines created three new factors in the U.S. wine industry. Easy drinking, easy to select, and fun and adventure, and eliminated or reduced everything else. Casella Wines found that the mass of Americans rejected wine because its complicated taste was difficult to appreciate. Beer and ready-to-drink cocktails, for example, were much sweeter and easier to drink. Accordingly, Yellowtail was a completely new combination of wine characteristics that produced an uncomplicated wine structure that was instantly appealing to the mass of alcohol drinkers. The wine was soft in taste and approachable like ready-to-drink cocktails and beer, and had upfront, primary flavors and pronounced fruit flavors. The sweet fruitiness of the wine also kept people's palate fresher, allowing them to enjoy another glass of wine without thinking about it. The result was an easy-drinking wine that did not require years to develop an appreciation for. In line with this simple fruity sweetness, Yellowtail dramatically reduced or eliminated all the factors the wine industry had long competed on—tannins, oak, complexity, and aging—in crafting fine wine, whether it was for the premium or the budget segment. With the need for aging eliminated, the needed working capital for aging wine at Casella Wines was also reduced, creating a faster payback for the wine produced. The wine industry criticized the sweet fruitiness of Yellowtail wine, seeing it as significantly lowering the quality of wine and working against proper appreciation of fine grapes and historic wine craftsmanship. These claims may have been true, but customers of all sorts loved the wine. Wine retailers in the United States offered buyers aisles of wine varieties, but to the general consumer the choice was overwhelming and intimidating. The bottles looked the same, labels were complicated with enological terminology understandable only to the wine connoisseur or hobbyist, and the choice was so extensive that sales clerks at retail shops were at an equal disadvantage in understanding or recommending wine to bewildered potential buyers. Moreover, the rows of wine choice fatigued and demotivated customers, making selection a difficult process that left the average wine purchaser insecure with the choice. Yellowtail changed all that by creating ease of selection. It dramatically reduced the range of wines offered, creating only two: Chardonnay, the most popular white in the United States, and a red, Shiraz. It removed all technical jargon from the bottles and created instead a striking, simple, and non-traditional label featuring a kangaroo in bright, vibrant colors of orange and yellow on a black background. The wine boxes Yellowtail came in were also of the same vibrant colors, with the name, Yellowtail, printed boldly on the sides. The boxes served the dual purpose of acting as eye-catching, unintimidating displays for the wine. Yellowtail hit a home run in ease of selection when it made retail shop employees the ambassadors of Yellowtail by giving them Australian Outback clothing, including bushman's hats and oilskin jackets to wear at work. The retail employees were inspired by the branded clothing and having a wine they themselves did not feel intimidated by, and recommendations to buy Yellowtail flew out of their mouths. In short, it was fun to recommend Yellowtail. The simplicity of offering only two wines at the start, a red and a white, streamlined Casella Wine's business model. Minimizing the stock-keeping units maximized its stock turnover and minimized investment in warehouse inventory. In fact, this reduction of variety was carried over to the bottles inside the cases. Yellowtail broke industry conventions. Casella Wines was the first company to put both red and white wine in the same shaped bottle, a practice that created further simplicity in manufacturing and purchasing and resulted in stunningly simple wine displays. The wine industry worldwide was proud to promote wine as a refined beverage with a long history and tradition. This is reflected in the target market for the United States, educated professionals in the upper income brackets. Hence the continuous focus on the quality and legacy of the vineyard, the chateaus or estates' historical tradition, and the wine medals won. Indeed, the growth strategies of the major players in the U.S. wine industry were targeted at the premium end of the market, with tens of millions invested in brand advertising to strengthen this image. By looking to beer and ready-to-drink cocktail customers, however, Yellowtail found that this elite image did not resonate with the general public, which found it intimidating. So Yellowtail broke with tradition and created a personality that embodied the characteristics of the Australian culture: bold, laid-back, fun, and adventurous. Approachability was the mantra. The essence of a great land, Australia. There was no traditional winery image. The lowercase spelling of the name Yellowtail, coupled with the vibrant colors and the kangaroo motif, echoed Australia. And indeed, no reference to the vineyard was made on the bottle. The wine promised to jump from the glass like an Aussie kangaroo. The result is that Yellowtail appealed to a broad cross-section of alcohol beverage consumers. By offering this leap in value, Yellowtail raised the price of its wines above the budget market, pricing them at $6.99 a bottle, more than double the price of a jug wine. From the moment the wine hit the retail shelves in July 2001, sales took off. The Eliminate, Reduce, Raise, Create grid. There is a third tool that is key to creation of blue oceans. It is a supplementary analytic to the four actions framework called the Eliminate, Reduce, Raise, Create grid. The grid pushes companies not only to ask all four questions in the four actions framework, but also to act on all four to create a new value curve. By driving companies to fill in the grid with the actions of eliminating and reducing, as well as raising and creating, the grid gives companies four immediate benefits. It pushes them to simultaneously pursue differentiation and low costs to break the value-cost trade-off. It immediately flags companies that are focused only on raising and creating, and thereby lifting their cost structure and often over-engineered products and services, a common plight in many companies. It is easily understood by managers at any level, creating a high level of engagement in its application. Because completing the grid is a challenging task, it drives companies to robustly scrutinize every factor the industry competes on, making them discover the range of implicit assumptions they make unconsciously in competing. The Eliminate, Reduce, Raise, Create grid for Cirque du Soleil provides another snapshot of this tool in action and shows what it reveals. Worth noting is the range of factors that an industry has long competed on that companies discover can be eliminated and reduced. In the case of Cirque du Soleil, it eliminated several factors from traditional circuses, such as animal shows, star performers, and multiple show arenas. These factors had long been taken for granted in the traditional circus industry, which never questioned their ongoing relevance. However, there was increasing public discomfort with the use of animals. Moreover, animal acts are one of the most expensive elements. Not only is there the cost of the animals, but also their training, medical care, housing, insurance, and transportation. Similarly, although the circus industry focused on featuring stars, in the mind of the public, the so-called stars of the circus were trivial next to movie stars. Again, they were a high-cost component carrying little sway with spectators. Gone too are three-ring venues. Not only did these create angst among spectators as they rapidly switched their gaze from one ring to the other, but they also increased the number of performers needed, with the obvious cost implications. Three characteristics of a good strategy. Yellowtail, like Cirque du Soleil, created a unique and exceptional value curve to unlock a blue ocean. As shown in the strategy canvas, Yellowtail's value curve has focus. The company does not diffuse its efforts across all key factors of competition. The shape of its value curve diverges from the other players, a result of not benchmarking competitors, but instead looking across alternatives. The tagline of Yellowtail's strategic profile is clear, a fun and simple wine to be enjoyed every day. When expressed through a value curve, then, an effective blue ocean strategy like Yellowtail's has three complementary qualities: focus, divergence, and a compelling tagline. Without these qualities, a company's strategy will likely be muddled, undifferentiated, and hard to communicate with a high cost structure. The four actions of creating a new value curve should be well guided toward building a company's strategic profile with these characteristics. These three characteristics serve as an initial litmus test of the commercial viability of blue ocean ideas. A look at Southwest Airlines' strategic profile illustrates how these three qualities underlie the company's effective strategy in reinventing the short-haul airline industry via value innovation. Southwest Airlines created a blue ocean by breaking the trade-offs customers had to make between the speed of airplanes and the economy and flexibility of car transport. To achieve this, Southwest offered high-speed transport with frequent and flexible departures at prices attractive to the mass of buyers. By eliminating and reducing certain factors of competition and raising others in the traditional airline industry, as well as by creating new factors drawn from the alternative industry of car transport, Southwest Airlines was able to offer unprecedented utility for air travelers and achieve a leap in value with a low-cost business model. The value curve of Southwest Airlines differs distinctively from those of its competitors in the strategy canvas. Its strategic profile is a typical example of a compelling blue ocean strategy. Focus. Every great strategy has focus, and a company's strategic profile or value curve should clearly show it. Looking at Southwest's profile, we can see at once that the company emphasizes only three factors: friendly service, speed, and frequent point-to-point departures. By focusing in this way, Southwest has been able to price against car transportation. It doesn't make extra investments in meals, lounges, and seating choices. By contrast, Southwest's traditional competitors invest in all the airline industry's competitive factors, making it much more difficult for them to match Southwest's prices. Investing across the board, these companies let their competitors' moves set their own agendas. Costly business models result. Divergence. When a company's strategy is formed reactively as it tries to keep up with the competition, it loses its uniqueness. Consider the similarities in most airlines' meals and business class lounges. On the strategy canvas, therefore, reactive strategists tend to share the same strategic profile. Indeed, in the case of Southwest, the value curves of the company's competitors are virtually identical and therefore can be summarized on the strategy canvas with a single value curve. In contrast, the value curves of blue ocean strategists always stand apart. By applying the four actions of eliminating, reducing, raising, and creating, they differentiate their profiles from the industry's average profile. Southwest, for example, pioneered point-to-point travel between mid-sized cities. Previously, the industry operated through hub-and-spoke systems. Compelling tagline. A good strategy has a clear-cut and compelling tagline. The speed of a plane at the price of a car, whenever you need it. That's the tagline of Southwest Airlines, or at least it could be. What could Southwest's competitors say? Even the most proficient ad agency would have difficulty reducing the conventional offering of lunches, seat choices, lounges, and hub links with standard service, slower speeds, and higher prices into a memorable tagline. A good tagline must not only deliver a clear message, but also advertise an offering truthfully, or else customers will lose trust and interest. In fact, a good way to test the effectiveness and strength of a strategy is to look at whether it contains a strong and authentic tagline. Cirque du Soleil's strategic profile also meets the three criteria that define Blue Ocean strategy: focus, divergence, and a compelling tagline. Cirque du Soleil's strategy canvas allows us to graphically compare its strategic profile with those of its major competitors. The canvas shows clearly the extent of Cirque du Soleil's departure from the conventional logic of the circus. The value curve of Ringling Brothers and Barnum & Bailey is the same basic shape as those of smaller regional circuses. The main difference is that regional circuses offer less of each competing factor because of their restricted resources. By contrast, Cirque du Soleil's value curve stands apart. It has new and non-circus factors such as theme, multiple productions, refined watching environment, and artistic music and dance. These factors, entirely new creations for the circus industry, are drawn from the alternative live entertainment industry of theater. In this way, the strategy canvas clearly depicts the traditional factors that affect competition among industry players, as well as new factors that lead to creation of new market space and that shift the strategy canvas of an industry. Yellowtail, Cirque du Soleil, and Southwest Airlines created blue oceans in very different business situations and industrial contexts. However, their strategic profiles share the same three characteristics: focus, divergence, and a compelling tagline. These three criteria guide companies in carrying out the process of reconstruction to arrive at a breakthrough in value both for buyers and for themselves. Reading the value curves. The strategy canvas enables companies to see the future in the present. To achieve this, companies must understand how to read value curves. embedded in the value curves of an industry is a wealth of strategic knowledge on the current status and future of a business. A blue ocean strategy. The first question the value curves answer is whether a business deserves to be a winner. When a company's value curve, or its competitors, meets the three criteria that define a good blue ocean strategy, focus, divergence, and a compelling tagline that speaks to the market, the company is on the right track. These three criteria serve as an initial litmus test of the commercial viability of blue ocean ideas. On the other hand, when a company's value curve lacks focus, its cost structure will tend to be high and its business model complex in implementation and execution. When it lacks divergence, a company's strategy is a me-too, with no reason to stand apart in the marketplace. When it lacks a compelling tagline that speaks to buyers, it is likely to be internally driven, or a classic example of innovation for innovation's sake, with no great commercial potential and no natural takeoff capability. A company caught in the red ocean. When a company's value curve converges with its competitors, it signals that a company is likely caught within the red ocean of bloody competition. A company's explicit or implicit strategy tends to be trying to outdo its competition on the basis of cost or quality. This signals slow growth unless, by the grace of luck, the company benefits from being in an industry that is growing on its own accord. This growth is not due to a company's strategy, however, but to luck. Over-delivery without payback. When a company's value curve on the strategy canvas is shown to deliver high levels across all factors, the question is, does the company's market share and profitability reflect these investments? If not, the strategy canvas signals that the company may be oversupplying its customers, offering too much of those elements that add incremental value to buyers. To value innovate, the company must decide which factors to eliminate and reduce, and not only those to raise and create, to construct a divergent value curve. An incoherent strategy. When a company's value curve looks like a bowl of spaghetti, a zigzag with no rhyme or reason, where the offering can be described as low, high, low, low, high, low, high, it signals that the company doesn't have a coherent strategy. Its strategy is likely based on independent sub-strategies. These may individually make sense and keep the business running and everyone busy, but collectively they do little to distinguish the company from the best competitor or to provide a clear strategic vision. This is often a reflection of an organization with divisional or functional silos. Strategic contradictions. Are there strategic contradictions? These are areas where a company is offering a high level on one competing factor while ignoring others that support that factor. An example is investing heavily in making a company's website easy to use, but failing to correct the site's slow speed of operation. Strategic inconsistencies can also be found between the level of your offering and your price. For example, a petroleum station company found that it offered less for more, fewer services than the best competitor at a higher price. No wonder it was losing market share fast. An internally driven company. In drawing the strategy canvas, how does a company label the industry's competing factors? For example, does it use the word megahertz instead of speed, or thermal water temperature instead of hot water? Are the competing factors stated in terms buyers can understand and value, or are they in operational jargon? The kind of language used in the strategy canvas gives insight as to whether a company's strategic vision is built on an outside-in perspective, driven by the demand side, or an inside-out perspective that is operationally driven. Analyzing the language of the strategy canvas helps a company understand how far it is from creating industry demand. The tools and frameworks introduced here are essential analytics used throughout this book, and supplementary tools are introduced in other chapters as needed. It is the intersection between these analytic techniques and the six principles of formulating and executing blue oceans that allow companies to break from the competition and unlock uncontested market space. Now we move on to the first principle, reconstructing market boundaries. In the next chapter, we discuss the opportunity-maximizing and risk-minimizing paths to creating blue oceans. Part 2. Formulating Blue Ocean Strategy. Chapter 3. Reconstruct Market Boundaries. The first principle of Blue Ocean Strategy is to reconstruct market boundaries to break from the competition and create blue oceans. This principle addresses the search risk many companies struggle with. The challenge is to successfully identify, out of the haystack of possibilities that exist, commercially compelling blue ocean opportunities. This challenge is key because managers cannot afford to be riverboat gamblers betting their strategy on intuition or on a random drawing. In conducting our research, we sought to discover whether there were systematic patterns for reconstructing market boundaries to create blue oceans. And if there were, we wanted to know whether these patterns applied across all types of industry sectors, from consumer goods to industrial products to finance and services to telecoms and IT to pharmaceuticals and B2B, or were they limited to specific industries? We found clear patterns for creating blue oceans. Specifically, we found 6 basic approaches to remaking market boundaries. We call this the 6 paths framework. These paths have general applicability across industry sectors, and they lead companies into the corridor of commercially viable blue ocean ideas. None of these paths requires special vision or foresight about the future. All are based on looking at familiar data from a new perspective. These paths challenge the 6 fundamental assumptions underlying many companies' strategies. These 6 assumptions, on which most companies hypnotically build their strategies, keep companies trapped competing in red oceans. Specifically, companies tend to do the following. Define their industry similarly and focus on being the best within it. Look at their industries through the lens of generally accepted strategic groups, such as luxury automobiles, economy cars, and family vehicles, and strive to stand out in the strategic group they play in. Focus on the same buyer group, be it the purchaser, as in the office equipment industry, the user, as in the clothing industry, or the influencer, as in the pharmaceutical industry. Define the scope of the products and services offered by their industry similarly. Accept their industry's functional or emotional orientation. Focus on the same point in time, and often on current competitive threats, in formulating strategy. The more that companies share this conventional wisdom about how they compete, the greater the competitive convergence among them. To break out of red oceans, companies must break out of the accepted boundaries that define how they compete. Instead of looking within these boundaries, managers need to look systematically across them to create blue oceans. They need to look across alternative industries, across strategic groups, across buyer groups, across complementary product and service offerings, across the functional emotional orientation of an industry, and even across time. This gives companies keen insight into how to reconstruct market realities to open up blue oceans. Let us examine how each of these 6 paths work. Path 1. Look across alternative industries. In the broadest sense, a company competes not only with the other firms in its own industry, but also with companies in those other industries that produce alternative products or services. Alternatives are broader than substitutes. Products or services that have different forms but offer the same functionality or core utility are often substitutes for each other. On the other hand, alternatives include products or services that have different functions and forms but the same purpose. For example, to sort out their personal finances, people can buy and install a financial software package, hire a CPA, or simply use pencil and paper. The software, the CPA, and the pencil are largely substitutes for each other. They have very different forms but serve the same function, helping people manage their financial affairs. In contrast, products or services can take different forms and perform different functions but serve the same objective. Consider cinemas versus restaurants. Restaurants have few physical features in common with cinemas and serve a distinct function. They provide conversational and gastronomical pleasure. This is a very different experience from the visual entertainment offered by cinemas. Despite the differences in form and function, however, people go to a restaurant for the same objective that they go to the movies, to enjoy a night out. These are not substitutes, but alternatives to choose from. In making every purchase decision, buyers implicitly weigh alternatives, often unconsciously. Do you need a self-indulgent 2 hours? What should you do to achieve it? Do you go to a movie, have a massage, or enjoy reading a favorite book at a local cafe? The thought process is intuitive for individual consumers and industrial buyers alike. For some reason, we often abandon this intuitive thinking when we become sellers. Rarely do sellers think consciously about how their customers make trade-offs across alternative industries. A shift in price, a change in model, even a new ad campaign can elicit a tremendous response from rivals within an industry, but the same actions in an alternative industry usually go unnoticed. Trade journals, trade shows, and consumer rating reports reinforce the vertical walls between one industry and another. Often, however, the space between alternative industries provides opportunities for value innovation. Consider NetJets, which created the blue ocean of fractional jet ownership. In less than 20 years, NetJets has grown larger than many airlines, with more than 500 aircraft, operating more than 250,000 flights to more than 140 countries. Purchased by Berkshire Hathaway in 1998, today, NetJets is a multi-billion dollar business with revenues growing at 30 to 35% per year from 1993 to 2000. NetJets' success has been attributed to its flexibility, shortened travel time, hassle-free travel experience, increased reliability, and strategic pricing. The reality is that NetJets reconstructed market boundaries to create this blue ocean by looking across alternative industries. The most lucrative mass of customers in the aviation industry are corporate travelers. NetJets looked at the existing alternatives and found that when business travelers want to fly, they have two principal choices. On the one hand, a company's executives can fly business class or first class on a commercial airline. On the other hand, a company can purchase its own aircraft to serve its corporate travel needs. The strategic question is, why would corporations choose one alternative industry over another? By focusing on the key factors that lead corporations to trade across alternatives and eliminating or reducing everything else, NetJets created its Blue Ocean strategy. Consider this. Why do corporations choose to use commercial airlines for their corporate travel? Surely it's not because of the long check-in and security lines, hectic flight transfers, overnight stays, or congested airports. Rather, they choose commercial airlines for only one reason. Costs. On the one hand, commercial travel avoids the high upfront fixed cost investment of a multi-million dollar jet aircraft. On the other hand, a company purchases only the number of corporate airline tickets needed per year, lowering variable costs and reducing the possibility of unused aviation travel time that often accompanies the ownership of corporate jets. So NetJets offers its customers 1/16th ownership of an aircraft to be shared with 15 other customers, each one entitled to 50 hours of flight time per year. Starting at $375,000, plus pilot, maintenance, and other monthly costs, owners can purchase a share in a $6 million aircraft. Customers get the convenience of a private jet at the price of a commercial airline ticket. Comparing first-class travel with private aircraft, the National Business Aviation Association found that when direct and indirect costs, hotel, meals, travel time, expenses, were factored in, the cost of first-class commercial travel was significantly higher. In a cost-benefit analysis for 4 passengers on a theoretical trip from Newark to Austin, the real cost of the commercial trip was $19,400, compared with $10,100 in a private jet. As for NetJets, it avoids the enormous fixed costs that commercial airlines attempt to cover by filling larger and larger aircraft. NetJets' smaller airplanes, the use of smaller regional airports, and limited staff keep costs to a minimum. To understand the rest of the NetJets formula, consider the flip side. Why do people choose corporate jets over commercial travel? Certainly it is not to pay the multi-million dollar price to purchase planes, nor is it to set up a dedicated flight department to take care of scheduling and other administrative matters. Nor is it to pay so-called deadhead costs, the costs of flying the aircraft from its home base to where it is needed. Rather, corporations buy private jets to dramatically cut total travel time, to reduce the hassle of congested airports, to allow for point-to-point travel, and to gain the benefit of having more productive and energized executives who can hit the ground running upon arrival. So NetJets built on these distinctive strengths. Whereas 70% of commercial flights went to only 30 airports across the United States, NetJets offered access to more than 5,500 airports across the country in convenient locations near business centers. On international flights, your plane pulls directly up to the customs office. With point-to-point service and the exponential increase in the number of airports to land in, there are no flight transfers. Trips that would otherwise require overnight stays can be completed in a single day. The time from your car to takeoff is measured in minutes instead of hours. For example, whereas a flight from Washington, D.C. to Sacramento would take 10.5 hours on a commercial airline, it is only 5.2 hours on a NetJets aircraft. From Palm Springs to Cabo San Lucas takes 6 hours commercial and only 2.1 hours via NetJets. NetJets offers substantial cost savings in total travel time. Perhaps most appealing, your jet is always available with only 4 hours notice. If a jet is not available, NetJets will charter one for you. Last but not least, NetJets dramatically reduces issues related to security threats and offers clients customized in-flight service, such as having your favorite food and beverages ready for you when you board. By offering the best of commercial travel and private jets and eliminating and reducing everything else, NetJets opened up a multi-billion dollar blue ocean, wherein customers get the convenience and speed of a private jet with a low fixed cost and the low variable cost of commercial airline travel. And the competition? According to NetJets, in the past 7 years, 57 companies have set up fractional jet operations. Of those, 57 have gone out of business. The biggest telecommunications success in Japan since the 1980s also has its roots in Path 1. Here we are speaking of NTT Docomo's iMode, which was launched in 1999. The iMode service changed the way people communicate and access information in Japan. NTT Docomo's insight into creating a blue ocean came by thinking about why people trade across the alternatives of mobile phones and the Internet. With deregulation of the Japanese telecommunications industry, new competitors were entering the market and price competition and technological races were the norm. The result was that costs were rising while the average revenue per user fell. NTT Docomo broke out of this red ocean of bloody competition by creating a blue ocean of wireless transmission, not only of voice, but also of text, data, and pictures. NTT Docomo asked, "What are the distinctive strengths of the Internet over cell phones and vice versa?" Although the Internet offered endless information and services, the killer apps were email, simple information, such as news, weather forecasts, and a telephone directory, and entertainment, including games, events, and music entertainment. The key downside of the Internet was the far higher price of computer hardware, an overload of information, the nuisance of dialing up to go online, and the fear of giving credit card information electronically. On the other hand, the distinctive strengths of mobile phones were their mobility, voice transmission, and ease of use. NTT Docomo broke the trade-off between these two alternatives not by creating new technology, but by focusing on the decisive advantages that the Internet has over the cell phone and vice versa. The company eliminated or reduced everything else. Its user-friendly interface has one simple button, the iMode button, I standing for Interactive, Internet, Information, and the English pronoun I, which users press to give them immediate access to the few killer apps of the Internet. Instead of barraging you with infinite information as on the Internet, however, the iMode button acts as a hotel concierge service, connecting only to pre-selected and pre-approved sites for the most popular Internet applications. That makes navigation fast and easy. At the same time, even though the iMode phone is priced 25% higher than a regular cell phone, the price of the iMode phone is dramatically less than that of a PC, and its mobility is high. Moreover, beyond adding voice, the iMode uses a simple billing service whereby all the services used on the web via the iMode are billed to the user on the same monthly bill. This dramatically reduces the number of bills users receive and eliminates the need to give credit card details as on the Internet. And because the iMode service is automatically turned on whenever the phone is on, users are always connected and have no need to go through the hassle of logging on. Neither the standard cell phone nor the PC could compete with iMode's divergent value curve. By the end of 2003, the number of iMode subscribers had reached 40.1 million, and revenues from the transmission of data, pictures, and text increased from 295 million yen, $2.6 million, in 1999, to 886.3 billion yen, $8 billion, in 2003. The iMode service did not simply win customers from competitors, it dramatically grew the market, drawing in youth and senior citizens and converting voice-only customers to voice and data transmission customers. Ironically, European and U.S. counterparts who have been scrambling to unlock a similar blue ocean in the West have so far failed. Why? Our assessment shows that they have been focused on delivering the most sophisticated technology, WAP, Wireless Application Protocol, instead of delivering exceptional value. This has led them to build overcomplicated offerings that miss the key commonalities valued by the mass of people. Many other well-known success stories have looked across alternatives to create new markets. The Home Depot offers the expertise of professional home contractors at markedly lower prices than hardware stores. By delivering the decisive advantages of both alternative industries and eliminating or reducing everything else, the Home Depot has transformed enormous latent demand for home improvement into real demand, making ordinary homeowners into do-it-yourselfers. Southwest Airlines concentrated on driving as the alternative to flying, providing the speed of air travel at the price of car travel and creating the blue ocean of short-haul air travel. Similarly, Intuit looked at the pencil as the chief alternative to personal financial software to develop the fun and intuitive Quicken software. What are the alternative industries to your industry? Why do customers trade across them? By focusing on the key factors that lead buyers to trade across alternative industries and eliminating or reducing everything else, you can create a blue ocean of new market space. Path 2. Looking across strategic groups within industries. Just as blue oceans can often be created by looking across alternative industries, so can they be unlocked by looking across strategic groups. The term refers to a group of companies within an industry that pursue a similar strategy. In most industries, the fundamental strategic differences among industry players are captured by a small number of strategic groups. Strategic groups can generally be ranked in a rough hierarchical order built on two dimensions, price and performance. Each jump in price tends to bring a corresponding jump in some dimensions of performance. Most companies focus on improving their competitive position within a strategic group. Mercedes, BMW, and Jaguar, for example, focus on outcompeting one another in the luxury car segment, as economy car makers focus on excelling over one another in their strategic group. Neither strategic group, however, pays much heed to what the other is doing because from a supply point of view, they do not seem to be competing. The key to creating a blue ocean across existing strategic groups is to break out of this narrow tunnel vision by understanding which factors determine customers' decisions to trade up or down from one group to another. Consider Curves, the Texas-based women's fitness company. Since franchising began in 1995, Curves has grown like wildfire, acquiring more than 2 million members in more than 6,000 locations, with total revenues exceeding the $1 billion mark. A new Curves opens on average every 4 hours somewhere in the world. What's more, this growth was triggered almost entirely through word of mouth and buddy referrals. Yet at its inception, Curves was seen as entering an oversaturated market, gearing its offering to customers who would not want it, and making its offering significantly blander than the competition's. In reality, however, Curves exploded demand in the U.S. fitness industry, unlocking a huge untapped market, a veritable blue ocean of women struggling and failing to keep in shape through sound fitness. Curves built on the decisive advantages of two strategic groups in the U.S. fitness industry, traditional health clubs and home exercise programs, and eliminated or reduced everything else. At the one extreme, the U.S. fitness industry is awash with traditional health clubs that catered to both men and women, offering a full range of exercise and sporting options, usually in upscale urban locations. Their trendy facilities are designed to attract the high-end health club set. They have the full range of aerobic and strength training machines, a juice bar, instructors, and a full locker room with showers and sauna, because the aim is for customers to spend social as well as exercise time there. Having fought their way across town to health clubs, customers typically spend at least an hour there, and more often two. Membership fees for all this are typically in the range of $100 per month. Not cheap, guaranteeing that the market would stay upscale and small. Traditional health club customers represent only 12% of the entire population, concentrated overwhelmingly in the larger urban areas. Investment costs for a traditional full-service health club run from $500,000 to more than $1 million, depending on the city center location. At the other extreme is the strategic group of home exercise programs, such as exercise videos, books, and magazines. These are a small fraction of the cost, are used at home, and generally require little or no exercise equipment. Instruction is minimal, being confined to the star of the exercise video or book and magazine explanations and illustrations. The question is, what makes women trade either up or down between traditional health clubs and home exercise programs? Most women don't trade up to health clubs for the profusion of special machines, juice bars, locker rooms with sauna, pool, and the chance to meet men. The average female non-athlete does not even want to run into men when she is working out, perhaps revealing lumps in her leotards. She is not inspired to line up behind machines in which she needs to change weights and adjust their incline angles. As for time, it has become an increasingly scarce commodity for the average woman. Few can afford to spend 1 to 2 hours at a health club several times a week. For the mass of women, the city center locations also present traffic challenges, something that increases stress and discourages going to the gym. It turns out that most women trade up to health clubs for one principal reason. When they are at home, it's too easy to find an excuse for not working out. It is hard to be disciplined in the confines of one's home if you are not already a committed sports enthusiast. Working out collectively instead of alone is more motivating and inspiring. Conversely, women who use home exercise programs do so primarily for the time-saving, lower costs, and privacy. Curves built its blue ocean by drawing on the distinctive strengths of these two strategic groups, eliminating and reducing everything else. Curves has eliminated all the aspects of the traditional health club that are of little interest to the broad mass of women. Gone are the profusion of special machines, food, spa, pool, and even locker rooms, which have been replaced by a few curtained-off changing areas. The experience in a Curves club is entirely different from that in a typical health club. The member enters the exercise room where the machines, typically about 10, are arranged, not in rows facing a television as in the health club, but in a circle to facilitate interchange among members, making the experience fun. The QuickFit circuit training system uses hydraulic exercise machines, which need no adjusting, are safe, simple to use, and non-threatening. Specifically designed for women, these machines reduce impact stress and build strength and muscle. While exercising, members can talk and support one another, and the social, non-judgmental atmosphere is totally different from that of a typical health club. There are few, if any, mirrors on the wall, and there are no men staring at you. Members move around the circle of machines and aerobic pads, and in 30 minutes complete the whole workout. The result of reducing and focusing service on the essentials is that prices fall to around $30 per month, opening the market to the broad mass of women. Curve's tagline could be, "For the price of a cup of coffee a day, you can obtain the gift of health through proper exercise." Curves offers distinctive value at a lower cost. Compared with a startup investment of $500,000 to $1 million for traditional health clubs, startup investments for Curves are in the range of only $25,000 to $30,000, excluding a $20,000 franchise fee, because of the wide range of factors the company eliminated. Variable costs are also significantly lower, with personnel and maintenance of facilities dramatically reduced and rent reduced because of the much smaller spaces required. 1,500 square feet in non-prime suburban locations versus 35,000 to 100,000 square feet in prime urban locations. Curve's low-cost business model makes its franchises easy to afford and helps explain why they have mushroomed quickly. Most franchises are profitable within a few months, as soon as they recruit on average 100 members. Established Curve's franchises are selling in the range of $100,000 to $150,000 on the secondary market. The result is that Curve's facilities are everywhere in most towns of any size. Curve's is not competing directly with other health and exercise concepts. It created new blue ocean demand. As the United States and North America become saturated, management has plans to expand into Europe. Expansion has already begun in Latin America and Spain. By the end of 2004, Curve's is expected to reach 8,500 fitness centers. Beyond Curve's, many companies have created blue oceans by looking across strategic groups. Ralph Lauren created the blue ocean of high fashion with no fashion. Its designer name, the elegance of its stores, and the luxury of its materials capture what most customers value in haute couture. At the same time, its updated classical look and price capture the best of the classical lines such as Brooks Brothers and Burberry. By combining the most attractive factors of both groups and eliminating or reducing everything else, Polo Ralph Lauren not only captured share from both segments, but also drew many new customers into the market. In the luxury car market, Toyota's Lexus carved out a new blue ocean by offering the quality of the high-end Mercedes, BMW, and Jaguar at a price closer to the lower-end Cadillac and Lincoln. And think of the Sony Walkman. By looking across the high fidelity of boomboxes with the low price and mobility of transistor radios within the audio equipment industry, Sony created the personal portable stereo market in the late 1970s. The Walkman took share from these two strategic groups. In addition, its leap in value drew new customers, including joggers and commuters, into this blue ocean. Michigan-based Champion Enterprises identified a similar opportunity by looking across two strategic groups in the housing industry, makers of prefabricated housing and on-site developers. Prefabricated houses are cheap and quick to build, but they are also dismally standardized and have a low-quality image. Houses built by developers on-site offer variety and an image of high quality, but are dramatically more expensive and take longer to build. Champion created a blue ocean by offering the decisive advantages of both strategic groups. Its prefabricated houses are quick to build and benefit from tremendous economies of scale and lower costs, but Champion also allows buyers to choose such high-end finishing touches as fireplaces, skylights, and even vaulted ceilings to give the homes a personal feel. In essence, Champion has changed the definition of prefabricated housing. As a result, far more lower to middle-income buyers have become interested in purchasing prefabricated housing rather than renting or buying an apartment, and even some affluent people are being drawn into the market. What are the strategic groups in your industry? Why do customers trade up for the higher group, and why do they trade down for the lower one? Path 3. Look across the chain of buyers. In most industries, competitors converge around a common definition of who the target buyer is. In reality, though, there is a chain of buyers who are directly or indirectly involved in the buying decision. The purchasers who pay for the product or service may differ from the actual users. And in some cases, there are important influencers as well. Although these three groups may overlap, they often differ. When they do, they frequently hold different definitions of value. A corporate purchasing agent, for example, may be more concerned with costs than the corporate user, who is likely to be far more concerned with ease of use. Similarly, a retailer may value a manufacturer's just-in-time stock replenishment and innovative financing, but consumer purchasers, although strongly influenced by the channel, do not value these things. Individual companies in an industry often target different customer segments, for example, large versus small customers. But an industry typically converges on a single buyer group. The pharmaceutical industry, for example, focuses overridingly on influencers, doctors. The office equipment industry focuses heavily on purchasers, corporate purchasing departments. And the clothing industry sells predominantly to users. Sometimes there is a strong economic rationale for this focus, but often it is the result of industry practices that have never been questioned. Challenging an industry's conventional wisdom about which buyer group to target can lead to the discovery of new blue oceans. By looking across buyer groups, companies can gain new insights into how to redesign their value curves to focus on a previously overlooked set of buyers. Think of Novo Nordisk, the Danish insulin producer that created a blue ocean in the insulin industry. Insulin is used by diabetics to regulate the level of sugar in their blood. Historically, the insulin industry, like most of the pharmaceutical industry, focused its attention on the key influencers, doctors. The importance of doctors in affecting the insulin purchasing decision of diabetics made doctors